Welcome to Managing Myelodysplastic Syndromes. I am Dr. Richard Stone, and today I'm going to discuss the current and future perspectives in the treatment of high-risk myelodysplastic syndromes. Here are my disclosures. The outline of my talk is going to center on high-risk disease, but just briefly to mention on lower-risk disease, we still use lenalidomide in 5q- patients. We use growth factors in non-5q- low-risk patients. And we have a new drug called luspatercept to be used in patients who have SF3B1 mutations or ring sideroblasts who have failed erythropoietin. In high-risk disease, which I'll cover extensively today, the backbone is still hypomethylating agent therapy, either IV or sub-Q azacitidine, IV decitabine, or now we have the oral decitabine, cytidine deaminase inhibitor, new drug which can be orally used. We transplant patients if possible with high-risk disease, and we have some new therapies that are kind of exciting to talk about, including the addition of venetoclax, TP53 folding agents, anti-CD47 antibodies, and checkpoint inhibitors. Now, when a patient comes in with possible MDS, we'd like to know their age, comorbid status, performance status, disease factors, including the proportion of marrow blasts, cytopenias, how many they have, cytogenetics, if they're getting transfusions, other marrow features, particularly ring sideroblasts and fibrosis, and while not yet routinely part of risk assessment, molecular features will become critical soon, no doubt. We still have this, quote, old, unquote, risk stratification system called IPSS, which is now well over 20 years old, but it's very simple. It divides people into four subcategories, and since four is divisible by two, that means the two on the left are the lower risk ones, and the two on the right are the higher risk ones, of which we'll center our discussion today. A more exact, but unfortunately, system which has five subcategories, which is not divisible by two, so we have to think about what to do with the intermediate groups, is a little bit more heavily weighted on the platelet count and on the cytogenetics, and divides folks, as I mentioned, into four subcategories, two of which are clearly high risk, and one of which is sort of high risk intermediate. We know now over a decade ago, my colleague Ralph Behar did an important study where he showed that the mutational spectrum will influence the prognosis. Namely, if you have one of these five mutations on the left-hand side of the slide, your prognosis slips by at least one IPSS group. Now, we're going to talk about venetoclax a great deal, and I just wanted to mention how it works. It's a BCL2 inhibitor, and BCL2 is responsible for preventing programmed cell death or apoptosis caused by cytotoxic stress, such as chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And the way BCL2 works, it binds to these pore makers in the mitochondrial cell membrane called BIM and BAX. And if you have a BCL2 inhibitor like venetoclax, the BCL2 cannot prevent pores from being formed by BIM and BAX. A couple of other molecules I'll be talking about today, EPR246, which is a so-called P53 refolding agent, which works in this horrendous subtype of MDS and AML called P53 mutant disease, and a very exciting group of molecules called anti-CD47 antibodies, which cover up the so-called don't eat me signal on the surface of the MDS cell and allow the macrophages to eat or kill the noxious cell. What we've had in high-risk MDS for the past couple of decades is hypomethylating agents. How did we come to that? We came to that due to an important trial done now in the first decade of this millennium, where azacitidine was compared to the standard of care, either low-dose ARA-C, 3 and 7 chemo, or supportive care for high-risk MDS. The response rate wasn't very impressive, 17% CR rate, and a few more people had improvements in various blood counts, but it was leading to a higher survival than the other three things I mentioned, and it became the standard of care. Since that point, we've added a few things like lenalidomide or histone deacetylase inhibitors to azacitidine, and we've been unable to show a benefit. But I will show you some data where adding venetoclax to azacitidine seems to have a high response rate. And I'll show you some other data where adding other things to AZA might be interesting. In point of fact, the first thing I want to talk about is venetoclax, which, as most of people in the audience will know, has been approved for use in older adults with AML that's not considered fit for chemotherapy. So AZA plus VEN is now the standard of care for patients over 75 with AML. And since that's not so different pathophysiologically from high-risk MDS, maybe we should add venetoclax to azacitidine. Indeed, my colleague, Dr. Garcia, presented this data at the recent ASH meeting, where indeed azacitidine was added to venetoclax was added to azacitidine. If we look at the safety expansion on the right, we can see that 14 days venetoclax seemed to be tolerable, and we wanted to see what the response rate was with 14 days of venetoclax with your standard 7-day azacitidine. And you can see from the bar graph on the left that the overall response rate is a whopping 79%, roughly double than what you'd expect with azacitidine alone. The complete remission rate is 39.7%, also double what you'd expect with azacitidine alone. But remember, this is an uncontrolled trial. There were cytopenias, at least initially, although the transfusion independence rate was pretty impressive, as you can see on the right. So should we be using azacitidine and venetoclax for high-risk MDS patients today? I would say no, not outside the context of a clinical trial. But indeed, there's an important industrial-sponsored trial of AZA plus or minus venetoclax in high-risk MDS, analogous to the Vialli A study that was published in New England Journal of Medicine last summer, showing the benefit of that combination in older adults with AML. You can see the median survival is not even reached for most of these patients. And so that's encouraging as well. Although again, the aforementioned phase 3 trial in MDS will have overall survival as the primary endpoint. What about if you fail azacitidine? Can you give venetoclax alone? You can, but the response rate, as you can see on the left, is only 8%, and most of those are not complete responses, of course. If you add azacitidine and add venetoclax and keep giving the azacitidine, the overall response rate is 40%. So it is it's potentially useful to a certain degree in people who, quote, failed azacitidine. However, once you fail azacitidine, as has been well known and shown many times over, the prognosis is poor. You can see that with venetoclax monotherapy, the median survival is about 3 months, and this is the progression-free survival. Progression-free survival is a little bit longer if you add VEN to your ongoing azacitidine, but still not very good. Now, oral HMA and MDS, yeah, we can do that now. It's a drug whose developmental name was AST-X727. It's said it is a uridine, which is a cytidine deaminase inhibitor. As you can see in the chemical graphic on the bottom, it prevents the inactivation of decitabine. It turns out if you give oral a pill with both cytidine in it and decitabine in it, you pretty much have the same drug as you do with IV azacitidine. And this ascertained trial, which was published last year by Garcia, Monero, and Blood, showed that this oral agent with these two drugs in it, the pill had these two drugs in it, was bioequivalent to IV azacitidine for 5 days. It was basically a PK study showing that the drugs were equivalent, almost 100%, one-to-one. And the response rates were what you'd expect with azacitidine, decitabine alone. Marrow CR was 46%, CR rate was 12%. Another oral agent which can occasionally be used in MDS is enasidenib, or for that matter, ivosidenib. These are drugs which are approved for relapse refractory AMLs with either an IDH2 for enasidenib or an IDH1 for ivosidenib mutation. You can see here the overall response rate is pretty high for untreated patients receiving azacitidine plus enasidenib. For those who failed HMA already, single-agent enasidenib had an appreciable response rate with some CRs. So that's pretty good. It's an option for the rare patient who has an IDH1 or IDH2 mutation, an IDH inhibitor either alone or with azacitidine. And the sine qua non for treatment of adults with high-risk disease is transplant. Do we transplant lower risk patients? No, we transplant higher risk patients. Based on this data from Corey Cutler at my institution, who showed that it's better to transplant patients who have high risk disease or DBD2 or high risk by the IPSS to save years of life. But if they have low risk disease, you should wait until they progress. His colleague, Dr. Cora, showed the same thing in the era of Rick Ellis stem cell transplant. And an important additional piece of data that Dr. Cutler supplied was presented at ASH in 2020, where he showed that in a donor versus no donor analysis in high risk MDS, that the overall survival was greater in those patients who had a transplant as opposed to those patients who were treated with chemotherapy alone. And of course, transplant's great, but not so great if you have a P53 mutation. The relapse rate's incredibly high for those people with P53 mutant MDS who have a transplant. This is data from another colleague of mine, Dr. Lindsley. And so there's a lot of focus on trying to improve the outcome for those with P53 mutated MDS. Now, another drug which may be useful in high-risk MDS is pevonedistat. This was presented by my colleague, Dr. Sekaris. Mikhail used this drug, which is a NED8 activating enzyme that blocks, it's an inhibitor of the NED8 activating enzyme, which blocks ubiquitination of select proteins upstream of the proteasome. And it's a sort of a neat mechanism of action and has potential to be useful along with azacitidine, getting rid of these blocking ubiquitization of select proteins and then blocking the enzyme that blocks that can allow these proteins to be degraded and promote apoptosis. Well, the proof of the pudding would be in a clinical trial. Here's a clinical trial that allowed people with higher risk MDS, higher risk CMML, or low blast count AML to go on. I'm going to present the data that Mikhail presented at ASH in just patients with higher risk MDS. And the trial was simply pevonedistat plus azacitidine versus azacitidine alone. The response rate in the combination was greater than the response rate with azacitidine alone. If we look at the CR rate, it was doubled from 27%, which is high for azacitidine alone, to 52% for the combination. The duration of response was also almost triple what it was in azacitidine alone, so promising. It was not really powered to show a survival benefit, and indeed it didn't show a survival benefit compared to AZA alone, but there was an event-free survival benefit with the PEV plus AZA. So they'll be doing a large phase 3 trial to try to show that PEV plus AZA is better than AZA in high-risk MDS, and of course that's going to be a competitor to the then plus AZA versus AZA phase 3 trial in high-risk MDS. And there are some people who say, well, pevonedistat has a lower likelihood of myelosuppression, so that might be useful for some patients who can't tolerate the myelosuppression inherent in use of venetoclax plus azacitidine. So let's talk about P53 targeting agents. This is a really interesting one called APR246, in which the misfolded mutant protein can be rehabilitated and reactivated with the use of this chemical, allegedly. And indeed, combining APR246, when presented last year, a very high response rate. You can see 87%, again, 53% CR rate. You'd think that would be enough to get the drug approved. Indeed, you can see that even in these bad patients, some of the patients, at least almost half, cleared their P53 mutation to a lower level in the marrow. The median survival was, well, about 15 months, encouraging but not curative. They started a phase 3 trial of APR246 plus AZA versus AZA alone, with a primary endpoint being complete remission rate, not even survival. And a press release in December suggested that the primary endpoint was not met. We haven't seen the full data about that yet, though. Finally, CD47, as I mentioned earlier, covers up this don't eat me signal on the tumor cell, in this case, the MDS cell. We know that CD47 high expression is a bad prognostic finding, at least in AML. So this drug, magrolimab, formerly called F5-F9, is a first-in-class drug that covers up this signal. You can see that it promotes phagocytosis in the bad guy cells, the blasts. So this trial was presented at ASH in AML and MDS of magrolimab plus azacitidine, and the primary objective was to make sure it was safe. You have to ramp up the dose because of an on-target anemia that one sees in due to the expression of CD47 on red cells, but you can get around that by ramping up the dose. You can see that almost all the patients responded by having their bone marrow blast count reduced. The overall response rate in first-line MDS, if you look on the left here, was 91% with 42% CRs. Again, there's a theme here. Then when you seem to add one of these newer agents to azacitidine, you get a pretty high response rate. Again, whether this is going to play out by showing major improvements in phase 3 trials remains to be seen. But what's particularly neat about magrolimab is that it seems to work, if you will, in P53 mutant disease. Sure, most of these patients shown here have AML with a P53 mutation, but the response rate was good, 75% in both MDS and AML. Again, the durability is a little questionable, but it's a good start. We don't have anything else like this if this plays out in subsequent trials. And some of the patients, as I mentioned, do clear their TP53 mutation. And the survival, well, in the wild type, it's quite good. In the P53 mutant diseases, both AML and MDS, you can see the median overall survival is 13 months. It's better than what we normally see, but again, phase 3 trials will tell the tale. One more thing to talk about is sabatolimab, which is a TIM-3 antibody. Again, used with HMA here. The complete remission rate is 33% when added to decitabine, 12% when added to azacitidine. Overall response rate is 65%. Perhaps not as impressive as the response rate ones we were seeing with either the APR246 or the anti-CD47, but still encouraging. Most prior trials with checkpoint inhibitors and MDS haven't been this favorable. So the proposed treatment algorithm for patients with MDS in 2021 is as follows. In lower risk disease, it's basically growth factors, which include erythropoietin. Erythropoietin failures in the right milieu may be responsive to luspatercept, and lenalidomide is used in 5q-. In the higher risk disease right now in 2021, at this particular point, we're still using one of the three available hypomethylating agents, either IV or sub-Q AZA, IV decitabine or oral decitabine / cytidineaminase inhibitor oral medicine. We're really looking for clinical trials. It's possible that IDH inhibitors can be used in those patients who have an IDH mutation, either IDH1 or IDH2. If they have an NPM1 mutation, that's more like AML. Perhaps standard AML chemotherapy should be used in that group. And we're always trying to think of clinical trials with venetoclax, with APR246, with anti-CD47, checkpoint inhibitors, NAD8 inhibitors, which are listed there, or other things. So it's an exciting time to be an MDS doctor where there's been a sort of a fallow period beforehand. But right now, we're in a good place. So I'd like to thank all my colleagues at Dana-Farber throughout the Harvard Cancer Center and across the world who helped me put this talk together and have done some of the seminal work in this field. I really thank you for viewing this activity, and please have a good day.